shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
We are playing the following recording on the true history of a great patriot by the late Mrs. Larry Lent, head secretary to Senator Joseph McCarthy, in honor of his birthday, November 14th, 1908.
I am delighted to talk about Senator McCarthy. And it is true, when people learn that I had been secretary to Senator McCarthy, they invariably want to know, what was he really like? To me, Senator McCarthy was a courageous American hero. His religious convictions and his deep love for his country were topmost in his mind. He believed in our Constitution and the American people, and he believed that he could help preserve liberty and justice by ridding the nation of its enemies. As for the man McCarthy, I liked and admired him tremendously. He was friendly and unassuming, the kind of a man which most people like the first time they meet him. He was generous, he was thoughtful, he had a brilliant mind and a fabulous memory. He was absolutely honest. He was kind and gentle, and he loved children. He had a good sense of humor and a positive outlook. He was morally clean, and in spite of all the malicious attacks on him personally, he was not at all bitter. This was really extraordinary. He was a grand person to work for. Now that is quite a list of attributes, which you may doubt, but I assure you I can prove every one of them. Before I go on, let me add that the senator loved this nation with such devotion that he actually inspired those around him, and it became a real joy working for him and with him for America. It seemed as if we were all part of his crusade. Now, Senator McCarthy had been Judge McCarthy of a circuit court in Wisconsin when the Japs bombed Pearl Harbor. He had joined the Marines and fought in the Pacific during World War II. When he returned, he ran for the Senate, and he won a surprising victory over La Follette. So now he was coming to Washington, a decorated Marine, a handsome, fearless, patriotic Irish-American, the heroic son of old-fashioned, God-fearing Christian parents, ready to serve in his government. To this Marine, who had fought and helped win a war, which he thought would assure peace and freedom for the world, imagine how he must have felt when he finally realized that his government had negotiated away our victory, and we had truly lost the peace. He soon began to realize that subtle treason had flowered in Washington, and the people did not have a patriotic watchman to warn them what was going on. And so it came as a terrible blow to learn that the Soviets would not only control half of Germany and half of Berlin, but Stalin had convinced our government to sacrifice Poland to the communists, as well as all the nations adjoining Russia, such as Romania, Czechoslovakia, Lithuania, Latvia, and so forth. These had all been free and independent countries, and there was really no good reason to let the communists take them over. But our president and some of our high officials liked Stalin, and it seemed they were convinced that by giving in to Soviet demands, they would assure peace in our time. And our surrender of China seemed just as pointless. Today, we are seeing the results. We saw them at Beijing. Now, once, when the senator was reminiscing about some interesting experience in the Pacific, he commented, let me quote him, "I came to know the Pacific and the coast of Asia as well as I did my dad's farm when I was a boy. And for the first time, I began to fully appreciate the great wisdom of America's long-term policy on Asia, the policy of maintaining a free, independent, friendly China in order to keep the Pacific, actually Pacific, in fact, as well as in name, And now I learned that our wise long-term policy was being scuttled. So Senator McCarthy, when he came to Washington, realized the situation in the Far East. Now, Senator McCarthy, the senator-elect, arrived in Washington December 1946, about 2 weeks before being sworn in. 3 days later, he and his administrative assistant were invited to have lunch with James Forrestal, Secretary of the Navy. The senator often wondered why the busy Secretary of the Navy discovered that a freshman senator had arrived in town and why he took so much time to discuss our nation's problems with him. I think we can see God's hand in this. And the senator often told us he thanked God many times for Forrestal's time and advice. Now, Forrestal was fully knowledgeable about communist penetration and influence in our government. He was able to bring Senator up to date on communist influence in our schools, in all our educational systems, in our news media, and definitely in our government. In the State Department, for instance, communists had recommended communists for jobs and then recommended each other for raises, till some of them were in policy-making positions where our foreign policy was definitely slanted towards Soviet objectives. Now, before talking with Jim Forrestal, Senator McCarthy admits he thought we were losing to communism because of incompetence or stupidity on the part of our national planners. He mentioned that to Forrestal. Senator McCarthy claimed he would never forget Forrestal's answer. McCarthy, he said, consistency has never been a mark of stupidity. If our State Department boys were merely stupid, they would make a mistake in our favor once in a while. Forrestal then told the senator that the FBI had not been asleep, however. All during the 30s and 40s, they had continued investigations of subversion and had copious files on communist infiltration into American government, but no way to bring it to the attention of the people, and no authority to remove traitors from government. At one time, the FBI had notified the President Truman, that a top official in his Treasury Department was favoring communists. In fact, they notified him 6 or 7 times, and Truman gave that suspected traitor a more responsible position. This man was Harry Dexter White, and we find him very active in our government and all their decisions. In fact, it was he who helped send our money plates to the Soviet Union. Now, Secretary Forrestal explained also, when the House Committee on Un-American Activities had held hearings and exposed Alger Hiss as a communist agent working in our State Department and reported this to President Truman, Truman had ridiculed the report, calling it a red herring. Secretary of State Dean Acheson proudly declared that he would never turn his back on Alger Hiss, a convicted traitor. Secretary Forrestal deserves our sincere appreciation. He did his task well. He informed Senator McCarthy of the dangers our nation faced. He furnished names and places and inspired the young senator to begin his crusade. It wasn't long before Forrestal fell or was pushed to his death from the Bethesda Naval Hospital. The Secretary of the Navy had challenged him, and Senator McCarthy was a fighter. Let's let Senator McCarthy tell about the beginning of his crusade in his own words. He said, "When I took on my duties as a senator, I discovered that certain outstanding senators and congressmen for years had been intelligently trying to alert the American people. Unfortunately, when they clearly and intelligently presented a picture of incompetence or treason, which should have commanded banner headlines in every newspaper, the story was found, if at all, hidden in the want ad. I witnessed the frustration of those honest, intelligent, loyal Americans who were attempting to expose our suicidal foreign policy. Day after day, I came into contact with convincing evidence of treason. Obviously, unless the public was aroused, the downward course upon which we were embarked would continue and at an accelerated pace. But what puzzled the senator was how to alert the American people. He became convinced that the American people could not be awakened by merely a discussion of traitorous policies generally. The men who made those policies, the specific traitors, or the dupes, well-meaning as they might be, had to be exposed. Foreign policy, after all, does not just happen. It is carefully planned by men with faces and names. Those faces and names had to be exposed. Senator McCarthy decided it did but little good to argue about changing our suicidal foreign policy so long as the men in charge of forming that policy were in the camp of the enemy. The change which had to be made if this country was to live was a change of the experts. The experts who had so expertly sold out China and Poland without the American people realizing what was happening. Day after day, Senator McCarthy admitted he came into contact with additional evidences of treason. More and more government employees were coming to him reporting suspicious activities in their department. Sometimes they had absolute proof of sabotage or espionage. Senator and his staff were spending a great deal of time following the leads that they were receiving, and more, the senator felt the need to awaken the American people. His first opportunity came when he was invited to speak at a Lincoln Day dinner in Wheeling, West Virginia, given by the Republican women of Wheeling. And so it was on February 9, 1950, when Senator McCarthy finally got his crusade underway. He began his speech with the statement that, "Today we are engaged in a final, all-out battle between communism and Christianity." He charged the communists with treason, threatened them all with exposure if they remained in our government. He declared he had the names of 57 communists working in our State Department. He also showed the copy of a letter written some time ago by Secretary of State Burns, stating that there had been 184 unfit persons employed in the State Department, and only 79 had been removed. Senator McCarthy pointed out this left 205 security risks still in our State Department. Senator did not know any of those 205, but he did have the names of the 57, which he had mentioned before, and he would be happy to give them to a loyalty board or some investigative committee for an executive session. All of this information was to be sent to the president, suggesting that he ask the present Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, to give him the names of those subversives still in the State Department. There were three important results of that speech. First, the press gave it some publicity, ridiculing the charges, of course, but at least admitting they were made. Second, the Senate appointed a committee to investigate Senator McCarthy's charges. Thirdly, the Communist Party lost no time in coining the word McCarthyism as they commenced their ferocious attack on the senator and on anyone else who would dare join him, of course. Let's look first at the committee which the Senate had appointed to look into McCarthy's charges. Senator Tidings of Maryland was to be its chairman. We were disappointed at this choice, for we feared he would not be a friendly chairman, and our fears were correct. The first move of the Tidings Committee was to challenge the numbers Senator McCarthy had given. In fact, both the committee and the communists juggled the numbers and confused everyone. In those days, speeches were not taped, and Tidings sent one of his employees, Dan Buckley, down to Wheeling to check with people who had heard the senator. Now, when Dan Buckley returned with affidavits from all the people he could locate who had heard McCarthy's speech, everyone agreed with the numbers given by the senator in his report. This was definitely not the report the committee wanted. Dan was sent down to Wheeling again, this time accompanied by a senior member of the committee. I had coffee with Dan after his first trip to Wheeling, and he told me that Tidings had been absolutely furious at that report. Tidings was evidently determined to destroy the credibility of Senator McCarthy. When the second visit failed to indicate McCarthy had lied, the committee fired Dan Buckley. Now, at first I couldn't understand why some senators were so antagonistic toward my senator. I finally came to the conclusion that they were jealous and beginning to fear maybe the American people were going to wake up and wonder why their senator had failed to warn them. Sort of sinning by omission it was. I guess I was right, because the people of Maryland refused to re-elect Tidings the next time he ran, and several other senators, like Benton of Connecticut, lost their bids to return to the Senate after attacking Senator McCarthy. And now, to the communist version of the word McCarthyism, which they had just coined, it was to be a dirty, hateful, disgusting word, meaning frightening attacks on innocent people, destroying their lives. It meant character assassination. It indicated a vicious witch hunt. The first time I actually saw the word in print was in the Daily Worker newspaper. This was the Communist Party newspaper published in New York City, which carried orders to American communists from the Soviet Union. And now the communist attack on Senator McCarthy came into full swing. Following Lenin's instructions, every effort was being made to smear and discredit his life, his character, his work, and particularly his method. Because some people did not understand what the commies called his method, and the press continued using the communist meaning, Senator McCarthy wrote a book explaining all that he was doing, and he named it McCarthyism, the Fight for America. Senator McCarthy did warn the American people to take a long look at what had happened to the Russians when the communist Bolshevik terrorists took over their country. All of a sudden, their freedom completely gone, millions murdered, and many millions of their farmers starved to death. It was a frightening picture, and McCarthy knew the true aim of the communists was total world domination. Back in 1946, one of the Soviet leaders, Dmitry Manuilsky, told his communist followers to be patient. He told them that war to the hilt between communism and capitalism is inevitable. Today, he told them, they are too weak to strike, but their day will come in 30 or 40 years. But first, he told them, we must lull the capitalist countries to sleep with the greatest overtures of peace and disarmament known throughout history. And then, when their guard is dropped, we shall smash them with our clenched fists. I think we need to remember that was in 1946, and nowhere have we seen any indication that they have changed their ultimate aim. When the senator's book, McCarthyism, The Fight for America, was printed, it was sent to libraries and bookstores throughout America, but it was hidden and almost never displayed. The news media continued to accept and publicize the communist versions of McCarthyism again and again. Over the years, it is a fact that when a lie is repeated often enough, people tend to believe it. As a result, even today, we have many uninformed people who think of McCarthyism as a dirty word. If people would just take time to do a little research, they would discover not McCarthy the evil accuser, but McCarthy the American hero. The integrity of his motives, the accuracy of his charges, and the validity of his message are vindicated by the truth. And of course, the truth is now that McCarthy was right. Let's think back to the Tidings Committee, which had been instructed to look into Senator McCarthy's charges of communists working in our State Department and or influencing the foreign policy of our nation. One of the first names Senator McCarthy gave the committee was the name of Owen Lattimore. I thought the senator must have been very sure of his facts, as Owen Lattimore was a highly respected Far Eastern authority to whom our State Department looked for advice on policy decisions. He was known all over the world for the books he had written, and the articles in magazines, mostly about China and the Far East. Also, he was a professor at Johns Hopkins University. The Tidings Committee seemed delighted. Surely, this was a perfect example of a wild man making irresponsible charges, and they promptly cleared Lattimore of having any communist bias. It was truly amazing to watch the news media join the attack on the senator and defend Owen Lattimore. Unless Senator McCarthy could be proven right, this looked bad for him. And you can imagine, we all sighed a huge sigh of relief when the Senate, at that very moment, established the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, a branch of the judiciary with authority to research and investigate any and all subversive movements or individuals in our nation. And we all said a prayer of thanks when the new committee, we called the SISS, was given the task of investigating any communist influence in the Institute of Pacific Relations, of which Owen Lattimore was one of its leaders. Senator Pat McCarran was chosen to be chairman of the new subcommittee. This was an excellent choice, as McCarran was well known for his anti-communist leanings. Chief counsel of the committee was to be Robert Morris, formerly with Naval Intelligence, whom I knew well. Ben Mandel was research director, and I understand he was at one time a member of the Communist Party and could be a wonderful help to the committee. There were several secretaries, and I believe they were looking for another secretary, one cleared for secret. I had naval clearance for secret, and I was working for the Navy at that time. I asked for release from my job with the Navy, and when they learned why I wanted the release, they gave it to me, and I secured the position with the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee. This was the same kind of work I had been doing for the Navy, and I was truly thrilled. I was placed in the Pentagon, in the Far East section of intelligence, where I took dictation from 6 or 7 intelligence officers reporting happenings in the Far East to the Admiral. It was here that I heard the names of many of the pro-communists and communists active in the Far East and much of what they were doing. I had for some time been closely following the charges being made by Senator Joseph McCarthy, particularly because the men he named were ones with which I was familiar from naval intelligence reports. Senator McCarthy was not a member of the Internal Security Subcommittee and had no connection with it, with the exception that we were going to investigate a man he had charged as subversive. And when the committee learned that some of the back files of the Institute of Pacific Relations had been hidden in a barn in Lee, Massachusetts, acting on the authority given them, the subcommittee took possession of those files and moved them to the Senate Office Building in Washington. Altogether, there were some 20,000 documents, including books, magazine articles, memorandums, letters, minutes, and reports, all of which were studied for the next 5 months. Some 2,000 became the preliminary basis for the committee's investigation, and now it was time to hold hearings. These hearings lasted about 6 months and included many witnesses along with the 28 Institute of Pacific Relations members. It has been conceded that this was the most important, careful, and productive investigation ever conducted by a committee of Congress. Those hearings became big news, followed closely by all the news media. Indeed, these were exciting days. The hearings were held in the Senate Judiciary Room, which adjoins our office, so we were in and out of the hearings and often taking dictation from one or more witnesses. A number of the IPR witnesses took the Fifth Amendment and refused to answer any questions. A number of them answered questions but failed to tell the truth. Owen Lattimore, remember him? The committee's final report states that Owen Lattimore testified falsely with reference to at least 5 separate matters that were relevant to the inquiry and substantial in import. The final report of the year's investigation was published in July 1952. Among other conclusions, we find the following, quote, "The effective leadership of the Institute of Pacific Relations used the IPR prestige to promote the interests of the Soviet Union in the United States." And another section read, "During the period 1945 to 1949, persons associated with the IPR were instrumental in keeping United States policy on a course favorable to communist objectives in China." And when it came to the reports on Owen Lattimore, they proved beyond any doubt that McCarthy had been right. The committee report stated, quote, "Owen Lattimore was, from some time beginning in the 1930s, a conscious, articulate instrument of the communist conspiracy," end quote. There was no doubt, was there? There were many more conclusions on a similar vein, many of them proving Senator McCarthy's charges of subversion and communist affiliation were correct. Now that the hearings were printed, I applied for a position with Senator McCarthy. My position was as assistant secretary, but shortly his secretary left on a protracted leave, and I moved into her position. I'll never forget the first time the senator called me to come into his office to take dictation. I had heard that he was very fast and very impatient, So I was a bit nervous as I gathered a handful of pencils in my shorthand book and went in. He greeted me pleasantly, explained that he was preparing an answer to letters requesting information, and after a few sentences, Senator stopped and turned and asked, "Larry, am I going too fast?" He wasn't, and I never worried again about taking his dictation. I think I had told you the senator was thoughtful, and indeed he was. Someone asked me if Senator McCarthy dictated all the letters that went out under his signature. I can assure you he did. He answered every letter which came from Wisconsin and many others. When the senator's reply would serve for a number of letters, the senator would dictate a form letter. When it was typed, he would read it carefully and then sign his name across the whole letter, which we could then use to answer all letters requesting that same information. Every letter that went out under his name, however, was signed by him personally. Now, while on the subject of letters, I must mention that no matter how busy he was, the senator always took time to dictate a letter to each young person writing for information. Sometimes it would take several pages to give the young person a complete answer, but he never failed. Senator McCarthy certainly loved young people, and little children loved him. Every time he was around little children, the first thing you'd see would be one of them on his lap, maybe one climbing on his shoulders. They just loved the senator, and he loved them. While I served as his secretary, all the mail which came into the office came over my desk. It was thrilling to read, because such a large percentage of the mail was favorable. I would say 85 to 90%. I believe I mentioned that the senator was generous. Let me give you just a few instances. Priests would write the senator from all over the world, suggesting that they needed certain books or other supplies. Without hesitation, the senator would authorize someone to get whatever the priest needed, charge it to his personal account, and send it on away to the priest. Because he was so generous, we often tried to handle requests ourselves. Once, when a mother from Wisconsin was expecting another baby, her carpenter husband had been hurt and couldn't work, therefore they needed all kinds of supplies, we placed a large box in the corner of our office and were gradually filling it with little gifts. When the senator saw the box, he wanted to know what it was for, so we had to explain. Right away, he suggested we buy a nice crib and send it to her with a card on it from the office secretary. Charge it to him, of course. There was one thing a bit unusual which I had noticed as soon as I joined the office staff, and that was the terrific amount of respect that each one of his staff felt for the senator. When addressing him, they all said, of course, Senator McCarthy. And when speaking of him, they invariably said, "The Senator." Not because he requested it, but their respect was shown in many ways. His staff knew him, knew how dedicated he was and how hard he worked. They also knew that he did not recklessly charge people with being communists, unless he was sure they were. As a matter of fact, he often warned us not to label anyone a communist unless we had seen their communist card. In those days, communists did carry cards. And now to the Eisenhower-Stevenson election. Most of my friends can't understand how Senator McCarthy could have voted for Eisenhower. The truth was that the news media had kept Eisenhower's dealings with Stalin from the public. And, of course, the senator didn't know that Eisenhower would become such a vindictive enemy. We did have information that Stevenson stood by the convicted communist Alger Hiss, declaring how much he admired him and how he was the best-informed man in the United Nations. And Senator McCarthy was convinced that Stevenson would be a dangerous man as president. The truth is that there really probably wasn't much choice, I don't think. Well, to get back to Senator's speech, exposing Stevenson's record, when I went into his office to take dictation for that talk, there were a number of agents giving documents to the senator and explaining their importance. If Senator McCarthy decided he would use the document, he dictated just what he would say in regard to that particular bit of information. He handed the document to me to be numbered. When the senator gave his speech in Chicago, he took along all the documents I had numbered and announced that everything he was going to say was well documented. and he invited all members of the press to come backstage as soon as he was finished to get the documentation. Not one reporter came back for his copy. And the next day, we all read in the Chicago papers about the vicious, unfounded charges Senator McCarthy had made. It really was a bit frustrating. But for his first 2 years in the Senate, Senator McCarthy was a one-man investigator with one or two men working with him. He exposed 81 subversives working in the State Department. All were proven guilty and removed from government work. The senator also had turned over the names of suspected communists in other branches of our government. He had also investigated waste and inefficiency in several government departments, which resulted in the saving of millions of dollars to the taxpayers. He was dedicated, and he was a hard worker. Early one morning, New Year's morning, another secretary and I had decided to work to catch up on a number of things that we had not done the week before. I had taken off my shoes and was comfortably sitting on the senator's desk while she read times, dates, and places to be put into the senator's desk calendar when all of a sudden the door flew open and there stood the senator. I think that was the shock of my life. He looked surprised and he asked, "Larry, what on earth are you girls doing here now?" When he realized what we were doing, he laughed and we all worked a full day. That didn't sound like a man who had been celebrating much the night before, did it? Senator McCarthy was being accused of drinking too much. Well, if he did, it wasn't during the day, because I sat next to him or across the desk from him every day taking dictation, and I never smelled liquor on his breath. He never offered people a drink in his office, as the news media had charged, because there never was a bottle in his office. But the attacks on Senator McCarthy continued. Some accused him of wanting to be president, as if that were a crime. But they tried to make it seem like it was a crime. Well, when they did that announce this, hundreds of people reacted differently. We were soon absolutely flooded with hundreds of letters of encouragement, and often containing everything from 50 cents to many dollars. We sent it all back with a gracious letter of appreciation from the senator, saying he really didn't want to run for president. He wanted to remain a senator from Wisconsin and fight on to rid our nation of treason. Some of us really wished he could be president. What a difference that would have made. We were all mighty proud of our senator, I can tell you. One time, Senator McCarthy did sue a newspaper for slander. That was the Syracuse Standard Times of Syracuse, New York. It was great to have that newspaper retract all the vicious lies they had printed. Now I hope the senator would sue the Washington Post. He could have easily won, but he refused to take the time. He felt that would please the communists because it would keep him from exposing more traitors and getting them removed. About that time, Louis Budenz, who had been editor of the Communist Daily Worker, had turned over the names of 400 Communist Party members, all employed in the newspaper and radio field. All these would require research and hearings. It would take the center staff a great deal of time to handle this. One day, the Marine Corps called from the Pentagon and wanted an appointment with the senator. They suggested one day the following week. I told the senator, and he asked me what they wanted. I really didn't know if I should have asked them, so I hadn't. Senator said, never mind, of course, he'd be glad to see them. When they arrived, there were a number of them and a man with a camera. They had come to present the Flying Cross with four or five medals, I forget which, but it was a very nice ceremony. However, it seemed to spark another attack on the senator. Some reporters wrote that he must have requested it. Drew Pearson featured it on three separate broadcasts in which he claimed he had seen McCarthy's Navy record and McCarthy had never even seen active duty. This was so ridiculous, Senator Kaine of the state of Washington was furious. He knew McCarthy's record. And because he knew that Senator McCarthy would never publicize it, Senator Kaine secured a copy and read it into the Congressional Record, where it is available for anyone who can read. Senator McCarthy was humble. I said he was, and he was. Now here is the Marine Record. United States Pacific Fleet, flagship of the Commander-in-Chief. the Commander-in-Chief, United States Pacific Fleet, takes pleasure in commending Captain Joseph R. McCarthy, United States Marine Corps Reserve, for serving as set forth in the following citation, for meritorious and efficient performance of duty as an observer and rear gunner of a dive bomber attached to a Marine Scout bombing squadron operating in the Solomon Islands area from September to December 31, 1943. He participated in a large number of combat missions, and in addition to his regular duties, he acted as aerial photographer and obtained excellent photographs of enemy gun positions despite intense anti-aircraft fire, thereby gaining valuable information which contributed materially to the success of subsequent strikes in the area. Although suffering from a severe leg injury, he refused to be hospitalized and continued to carry out his duties as intelligence officer in a highly efficient manner. His courageous devotion to duty was in keeping with the highest traditions of the naval service. This was signed by C.W. Nimitz, Admiral, United States Navy. Now, I read that entire commendation because I believe some of you saw NBC's film entitled Tail Gunner Joe, supposedly portraying the life and character of Senator McCarthy. It was undoubtedly one of the most monstrous, diabolical distortions it has ever been my misfortune to see. One must wonder why they are still trying to destroy the memory of the great anti-communist senator. Do they want to make certain that another pro-Christian anti-communist fighter doesn't begin another crusade? The TV program Tail Gunner Joe not only ridiculed Senator McCarthy as a Marine shooting down coconuts, but they portrayed one untruthful act after another. In an obvious attempt to make the senator look irresponsible, they enacted a completely fictitious scene of him as a boy wrecking a truckload of chickens and then abandoning the truck, the chickens, and all in the ditch. If these producers of this show had been interested in the truth, it was all printed in the Wisconsin State Journal on July 16, 1946. Let's look at a few quotes from the journal. Quote, they said, Joe's youth wasn't much different from that of other Wisconsin farm youngsters. He worked in his dad's farm, and with $65 earned by working for an uncle in his spare time, Joe started a chicken farm. He had built his business to 2,000 laying hens and 10,000 broilers when influenza put him to bed for several weeks, and neighborhood boys who tended the flock didn't display the same enthusiasm that Joe did. Result, thousands of dead chickens and Joe out of business. Continue this story. This is from the Wisconsin State Journal. Joe moved to a neighboring town and got a job. He finally got two jobs and then decided he should go back to school. At 19, he entered the local high school, and according to the Wisconsin State Journal, he jammed 4 years of high school into one. He passed the final exams with flying colors and ended on the honor roll. Principal L.D. Hershberger, in passing out the diplomas, described the boy who had completed the four-year high school course in 1 year while working at two jobs as, quote, the irresistible force who overcame the immovable object. I believe I told you before that when the Second World War started, Joe McCarthy was a judge. He couldn't let his country fight a war without him, so he turned his judgeship over to another and volunteered in the Marines. Now let's go back to his crusade in the Senate. There were times when it was rather tense in our office, when we couldn't help but wonder if some radical might toss a bomb in our door. Not only were we hated by the communist traitors, but there were Americans who supported the communists because they honestly believed communism, or what they thought communism was, would be far better for the working man than capitalism. And they hated us, too. It would help our mood sometimes to have a good laugh. And I told you that Senator McCarthy had a good sense of humor. Once, the senator learned that a con man was claiming he had access to our office and would report what went on for a price. Several groups started paying him. We learned that the ADA, the Americans for Democratic Action, some members of the Democrat Party, the Washington Post, and probably some other newspaper representatives were paying. I think the con man was Paul Hughes. I'm not sure. Anyway, this man furnished some fabulous tales of the events of our office. And he never, ever even opened our front door and came in. Some of the stories were drifted back to us, and they were hilarious. A taxi driver supplied more laughs. One afternoon, the senator took a taxi home. When he stepped into the cab, the driver began telling him stories he had heard about what McCarthy was doing to hurt people. He evidently hadn't recognized the senator, who then kept encouraging him to tell another story and then another story. When they finally drove up to the senator's home, and the senator's car was out in front, the driver couldn't apologize enough, and they had a good laugh together. When Roy Cohn died of AIDS a year or so ago, a lot of people remembered that he had worked for Senator McCarthy, and they asked me how the senator could have hired such a person. In order to explain that, I must go back to the time Republican Eisenhower won the presidency, and all Republican senators took over the chairmanship of the Senate committees. Senator McCarthy became chairman of the Government Operations Committee and its Permanent Investigations Subcommittee. This gave him a tremendous boost, and as a matter of fact, I believe he held many more hearings than had ever been held by that committee. He had planned on Bob Morris coming over from Senate Internal Security Subcommittee to be his chief counsel. Senator Jenner, who was taking over the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, was about to investigate some cases of subversion in the United Nations, and he needed Bob Morris. We were then without a chief counsel, and anti-communist lawyers were scarce. A number of people suggested Roy Cohn. Senator realized he was very young. He was also known as a liberal. But recently, he had done a fine job prosecuting communists in New York. So Senator hired him, and I found myself Roy Cohn's secretary. From the beginning, there was serious friction between Roy and Bobby Kennedy, who was minority counsel. They used the same office spaces and the same secretaries. The first order that Roy gave me was to set up his office space, but the next was never to let Bobby have our best secretary. So from then on, when Bobby asked for Ruth, I had to tell him she was too busy or something and send him another girl from our pool of secretaries. In a couple of days, a friend of Roy's arrived to work as a dollar-a-year man, and we set him up in the office, too. As soon as he got his phone, he called the Pentagon, trying to get the address of a soldier. I heard him having some trouble if he had to wait till the next day, and I heard him use Senator McCarthy's name. So I called Don Serene, Senator's top investigator. Don called the Army and apologized and straightened it out with that officer. This was the first brush those two young fellows had with the Army, but it was not the last, I'm sorry to say. Senator never criticized Roy. He always defended his employees. But I believe those two boys were the reason a lot of other senators turned against our committee, and I feel they did more harm than good in our crusade. I've also had many questions about the Army-McCarthy hearings. The first thing we need to remember was that this TV extravaganza was a trumped-up affair to stop McCarthy and his investigation of communists and traitors in our government. He was stepping on too many toes. Actually, the charges against Senator McCarthy were so falsely manufactured that even the Secretary of the Army, Robert Stevens, confessed that they were without substantial foundation. Those were his exact words. Millions of Americans who watched the hearings realized the senator was being harassed, and reports were that most listeners liked our senator and what he stood for. It was true that Roy Cohn had requested the Army allow his friend to remain near Washington after he was drafted so he could work with the committee, but I'm not at all sure that even the senator ever even asked. And then there was the Perez case. Senator had evidence proving Dr. Irving Perez, then Captain Perez in the Army of the United States, was a communist, and he was soliciting for the Communist Party. and Senator McCarthy so advised the Army. Instead of investigating or turning the case over to a loyalty board, the Army had given Perez a raise to major and an honorable discharge. Now, this did infuriate the senator. However, none of this was worthy of such a waste of their taxpayers' money and the time of the men who could have spent their days better serving our nation than that ridiculous hearing. I think those hearings were a disgrace to our country. I have really only touched the surface of all the treason and stupidity that Senator McCarthy exposed. As a result of his investigations, many subversives were removed from our government. And I believe the communist timetable was set back many years. On Washington's birthday, 1956, arrangements were made for Senator McCarthy and Jenner, Senator Jenner, to speak at Carnegie Hall, New York City. It was reported they had an overflow audience, but it was much more than that. We had arrived an hour in advance, and the hall was practically full already. Shortly, buses filled with cheering people, waving American flags and McCarthy banners, began to pull up at the entrance. So we had hundreds of patriots from Connecticut, Upper New York State, New Jersey, and I even noticed one from Rhode Island and other states. Hurriedly, loudspeakers were secured and put in place so that those out front could at least hear what was being said. It brought tears to many eyes to hear those cheers of approval, not only from those inside, but from all the buses parked along the curbs outside. For a couple of senators who were taking so much slander and abuse, it surely must have been an encouragement. I will never forget that afternoon. And I don't believe any of those who were there will either. For one thing, General Douglas MacArthur was honored. A lot of us already were aware that the American people loved General MacArthur. I was in the Senate when Truman recalled him. Never in the history of our nation has mail poured into the Senate post office in such tremendous quantities. The post office didn't close day or night for a spell. Sacks of letters were dumped on the floor of the senator's entrance hall. Each secretary was told to take 100 at a time, read them, and jot down how many for MacArthur and how many in favor of Truman recalling him. It was absolutely wonderful to read those letters because over 90% were furious at what Truman had done and praised General MacArthur. Some wished he could be president, and we all wished he could too. Senator McCarthy began his talk that day with praise of General MacArthur. "I choose to make General MacArthur the focal point of my remarks tonight," he said, "because on the one hand, he proves that America is still capable of producing men in the great tradition of George Washington. On the other hand, MacArthur's present exile is eloquent testimony to the fact that the reigning liberal bipartisan machine has also cast into exile the principles of national honor, national wisdom, and national freedom for which Washington stood." As McCarthy spoke, there was almost a religious fervor in the hall, and I heard a number of amens. What a lot of Christian patriots that were there to honor their new leaders. Senator McCarthy explained 14 mistakes our government had made in dealing with the Far East problem, mistakes which seriously injured our prestige and leadership, and he offered suggestions on how they should have been and now could be handled. I think you will be very interested in all of them, but I'll only take time to read two or three. One, in December 1945, he explained, the American government instructed the Chinese people that the only way to keep American friendship was to take communists into their government. George Catlett Marshall, General Marshall, went to China for our government and presented this ultimatum to them. Second, on January 1947, our government made good on the ultimatum. Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the anti-communist Chinese forces, had refused to take communists into his government, and Truman had cut off all their supplies, and the communists then took over China. When I saw the tragic slaughter at Beijing, I couldn't help but feel ashamed for my country. As Lattimore had suggested, we should let China fall, but don't let it look like we pushed them, but we did. Then, on November 3rd, 1950, Senator McCarthy explained, the American armies were fighting in Korea, and they were attacked by Chinese communist troops. The American government ordered its military commanders not to bomb Chinese bases or supply lines, even though American troops were in danger of destruction. The reason given, this might bring China into the war. And believe it or not, our country had turned down the Chinese anti-communist forces' offer of 33,000 troops to help fight the Chinese communists and Korean communists. Also, and I don't suppose you read this in many history books, American forces were protecting the communist Chinese coast. The American fleet was ordered to protect Red China against the anti-communist nationalist raids. And our 7th Fleet was ordered to protect shipments of military supplies for the Red Chinese forces killing American boys. Senator McCarthy continued to explain all 14 errors he felt our government had made. And as a last case, he told them, let me quote from the senator's own report. His report was given, as late as May 1955, the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations reported on the basis of questioning top State Department, Defense Department officials that 481 American prisoners of war were still unaccounted for and were believed to be in Chinese prisons. Last year, with great fanfare and by making who knows what concessions to the Reds, we obtained the release of 15, which means leaves 466 American fighting men whom the mightiest nation on earth is evidently not lifting a finger to protect. I say the world will never respect us, will never acknowledge us as a worthy leader in the anti-communist cause until it learns that when an American soldier goes overseas, he packs on his shoulders the entire strength of the United States of America. The nation owes the same duty to the soldier as the soldier owes to the nation. Senator McCarthy continued, therefore, I repeat what I have urged 100 times before, that we put Red China in an economic straitjacket, that so long as an American boy remains in communist control, that no American money to nations that trade with Red China, in strategic supplies or otherwise. One of the results of the Geneva Friendship Meeting is that we are now permitting our alleged allies to ship highly strategic war supplies to the Soviet Union. This policy, of course, affects the Far East, as well as other parts of the world, since Communist China gets what she needs from Communist Russia. This was the subject the senator stressed in press releases. I can't remember that there were any more boys released after that. Now, I won't take time to go into all of the mistakes, Senator McCarthy explained, but I should mention the suppression of the Wedemeyer Report. General Wedemeyer was one of our top intelligence officers who had prepared a special report to Congress on how China could be saved from communist conquest. This special important report has been withheld from the Congress. When the Armed Services Committee of the United States Senate learned of this, they asked General Marshall why he had joined in the suppression of that report. Marshall replied, I did not join in the suppression of that report. I personally suppressed it. And Congress did not have that report to use in their making their decision. Senator McCarthy kept finding more and more references to General Marshall as he continued his research into the reason China fell to the communists. When he heard that the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House had been requested to approve the arming of, by America, of 10 Chinese communist divisions, he could hardly believe it. And then he learned that Secretary of State Dean Acheson reported that General Marshall had agreed to assign 69 United States officers and 400 tons of American equipment to train 10 communist Chinese armies. This was incredible. And when Senator McCarthy had completed his research, he gave a report of General Marshall's record to the Congress and printed his book, Retreat from Victory, The Story of George Cabot Marshall. Now, General Marshall had been built up as such a great general and hero by the press that most people had a hard time believing the truth. But his book was completely documented. Before I finish, remember in describing Senator McCarthy, I used the word gentle. Now, that does sound a bit strange for such a masculine man, but he was gentle. The author, Brent Bozell, who is known as a good judge of character, wrote, quote, "I studied Senator McCarthy's work, and I helped write a book about it. And in the course of professional interviews, I caught glimpses of the buoyancy, the strength of will, the awesome single-mindedness, the gentleness of this man." And so Brent Bozell saw what I saw. Now, another character witness I'd like to quote is William Rusher, publisher of National Review. After the senator had been censured, Rusher thought that perhaps this would be a good time to find out if the senator was ever bitter. After his interview, Rusher commented that bitterness was just not in Senator McCarthy's character. And then he added, let me quote his next comment. "We might interject here that, surprising as it may sound, the dominant quality in Senator McCarthy was a singular sweetness in his character. This was at once the key to his success, since in its purity depended his courage, and it was courage that put him in the forefront of anti-communists, many of whom were more knowledgeable than he, and it was the cause of his downfall. For valiant though he was in fighting for his country or for principle, he could not be ruthless in fighting for himself," end quote. Now, I almost forgot to tell you about Senator's marriage to Jean Kerr, and it was a very important and a very beautiful part of his life. Jean had worked for the senator and had helped write his book, McCarthy Isn't the Fight for America. Jean was a beautiful, very smart girl. We all loved her dearly. This marriage was a very happy marriage. Now, I guess this brings us to Senator McCarthy's death. Yeah, he was in his 40s when he died on May 2nd, 1957. He died at Bethesda Naval Hospital, the same hospital from which that other patriot, Secretary of the Navy Forrestal, fell or was thrown to his death. Senator McCarthy's death certificate read, "Hepatitis unknown." Now, there were so many conflicting reports concerning his death that it is very confusing. Medford Evans, the man who wrote The Assassination of Joseph R. McCarthy, was convinced that the senator had been murdered, and I am inclined to agree with him. I hope his life, though, will encourage others to learn the truth, and I pray that the truth will lead America back to a Christian government. Joseph McCarthy was buried at Appleton, Wisconsin, where every spring there is held a memorial service. God bless the memory of a great Christian patriot, Joseph R. McCarthy.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com, type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.